It is 10:36. I am proud to introduce Dr. John Holsterman, PhD, Chief of Disability and Accessibility Services for Paradigm Testing, and he is here to talk to us about ADA test accommodation requests. Mr. Holsterman, the meeting is yours.
Thanks, Karen. So I am looking at my slide deck. I can't see any of you. Or myself. Hopefully I'm in the screen and you all can hear me and see me.
We can see you and hear you.
Okay, and you can also see my slides.
Correct.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, awesome. This is a little funky. Because I'm just talking to my slide deck. It's a little different than Zoom where I can see my slides and see people. So, well, thank you all for having me present this afternoon. So, I've got a slide deck that's going to guide our conversation on test accommodations. And I would welcome questions along the way, but it is a fairly meaty slide deck. So, if there are questions that you have that you think are going to take a bit longer to answer, maybe we can closer to the end when I finish the slides, and I think we'll have some time for questions that are more complex at that point. So we're going to go through a bit of a legal review that kind of gives us a little bit of a framework for talking about test accommodations. Then we're going to talk about how it's maybe a bit different than some of our test candidates are used to from the process of requesting accommodations at university or in their doctoral programs. We'll talk about the review process itself, and then we'll look at a number of cases. And that's why I was a little bit cautious about video recording the slides, because there are some cases, they have been redacted, but I'm always a little cautious about recording those and potentially sharing those with a wider audience. So with that, I'm not giving you legal advice. I'm going to give you my best advice, having been in this business for more years than I will admit to. best practices as I know it. And you will find a little bit of humor in the slides. If you share my sense of humor, great. If you don't, I'm sorry. Bear with me. But it's who I am, and you'll just have to live with it for the next hour and a half. So just a little bit of background about me, for those of you who don't know me. I do accommodations reviews through Paradigm Testing. We manage or help manage the accommodations review process for about 20 different certification licensure organizations, high stakes testing organizations. Many of them are in the health professions. We review for organizations both in the U.S. and Canada. We are the escalation path, I guess you could say, for the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy and a number of states that have joined their interstate compact, or I don't understand what the whole thing is behind the scenes, but through FSBPT, we at Paradigm review accommodations requests for a number of states. And that's pretty much all I'm going to say about myself, I guess, at this point. I would ask you if you're not speaking, in other words, if you're not me, if you could put yourself on mute, that would probably be helpful to the group. So a little bit of legal background here. I like The Simpsons. Hope you do too. So what is a disability? This pretty much forms the foundation of all of the rest of the slides that we'll be talking about this afternoon. Well, it's afternoon for me. I guess it's still morning for you. So a disability is a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. And we're going to talk about what each of these parts of the definition, what each part means. What is an impairment? What does substantially limit mean? And what is a major life activity? What is an impairment? An impairment is considered to be a valid condition that's appropriately diagnosed following a globally recognized set of criteria. For mental health disorders, that's DSM-5. For everything else, ICD-9 or 10. That should be something familiar to most of you all. So an impairment is a valid diagnosed condition. But impairment is only the beginning of the definition. So somebody with a disability has to be somebody with an impairment, but that's not the end of the story, right? So it's an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. It's not just an impairment. It's an impairment that substantially limits. Now, for every valid diagnosed condition, which would be an impairment, there's a range, there's a continuum of impairment. And if you think about pretty much any diagnosis, you can think of it as having a range or a continuum of impairment. So whether that's a physical condition or a mental health condition, a psychological disorder, here is an example of the range of impairment for people diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis. So all the people on this scale have the same diagnosis, right? But they're not all disabled. So if you think about people who are initially diagnosed with MS, when they're first diagnosed, you can see over on the left-hand side there, there may be virtually no discernible impairment to friends and neighbors, things like that. They may be able to engage in virtually all of the same activities that they always have been engaged in. They may have some very mild, maybe tingling in the fingertips or toes, or maybe a little bit of occasional blurry vision or headaches or something like that. But for the most part, people on the left-hand side are doing pretty well. Now you can see as the disease progresses, the impairment becomes more noticeable and begins to impact their day-to-day functioning. Somewhere along the way, around number three or number four, maybe they have to give up tennis, right? But they're still going to work. They're still, you know, functioning on a day-to-day basis, you know, in most ways as they previously did. We start moving along to six and seven. The person has trouble walking. They need a disability placard for their car, so they don't have to park so far away. They have to give up a number of maybe daily activities that involve walking, and so forth. Somewhere along the way on this scale, the person crosses over into the world of disability. But it's not over at zero, right? So again, people on the left-hand side of this scale have a diagnosis of MS, but they're not disabled, right? Only somewhere along the way here, when their major life activities become substantially limited, that's the definition of disability again, somewhere along the way, they become disabled. But they're not disabled by virtue of their diagnosis. They're disabled because of the substantial limitations to their major life activities. Now, the same concept applies to people with invisible conditions. So people with attention deficit disorder, ADHD, people with learning disorders, with reading disorders, with mental health disorders, depression, bipolar, anxiety. Those are all diagnoses. By virtue of the diagnosis itself, they're not automatically disabled, right? The diagnosis just kind of tells us what continuum they're on. Are they on the multiple sclerosis continuum? Are they on the ADHD continuum? Are they on the dyslexia continuum? But the diagnosis itself does not tell us whether they're disabled or not, right? This is a difficult concept for our candidates to grasp, because they and their doctors believe that by virtue of the diagnosis, they're automatically disabled, and that is not the case. All right, hopefully this makes sense to everyone. I like to use the concept that it's called the Americans with Disabilities Act. It is not the Americans with Disorders Act. It's not the Americans with Diagnoses Act. It's not the Americans with Discrepancies Act. It's the Americans with Disabilities Act. So again, just because somebody has a valid diagnosis of an impairment does not automatically mean that they're disabled. Now, another key concept here that we need to talk about, this is under the broad umbrella of legal stuff. The question becomes, who's the reference group? So when we were talking about the multiple sclerosis scale, the reference group was other people, right? The person can play tennis and then they have trouble walking, and then the condition becomes much worse, they become disabled, and the reference group is other people. Well, the same thing is true for all other conditions. The reference group is most people. And so when we're thinking about something like attention deficit disorder, the question about disability is their functioning substantially limited compared to most people in the general population? It's easy to see when we have a physical impairment, when we have something like MS or a visual impairment or a hearing impairment, it's obvious that the reference group is most people. But when we get to things like ADHD and reading disorders, sometimes our candidates and their evaluators believe that the reference group is the person's doctoral peers. That's not the case. The reference group, when we're trying to determine disability, is most people in the general population. Not somebody's own very high IQ score, not somebody's doctoral classmates. The reference group is most people in the general population. So I wanted to just give you an example of this from a case that was involving a high-stakes licensure organization. This is the National Board of Osteopathic Medical Examiners. So they license osteopathic physicians. Mr. Healy was a med student. He had a great academic record, no history of accommodations, but he was diagnosed with a reading disorder, right? His reading disorder was based on the fact that he had a very high IQ and only average or slightly above average reading scores. And there was a big discrepancy there between his high IQ and his merely average or above average reading scores. And that discrepancy was statistically significant. And so the psychologist diagnosed a reading disorder. Based on the diagnosis, he believed he was disabled. And the court said, no, you're not disabled because even your lowest scores are still normal or above average compared to most people in the general population. And that's the appropriate reference group for determining disability status. Not your 146 IQ, right? Not your medical school peers, most people in the general population. I can't see you all, so I'm hoping that some people are nodding their heads or taking notes or something like that. Karen, is all as well?
Yep, all is well. You're doing great.
Okay, I'll just keep talking then.
Yeah, I know, it's hard. You know, you could try to change and see us potentially with those three dots at the bottom and change your screen orientation. Uh-huh. And that might allow you to see us, but sometimes when you share the screen, it's the whole screen.
Yeah. All right. Well,
but we can see you. You're doing okay. Great. Keep going.
All right. I'll just keep rolling here. I feel like I'm talking to myself.
And anybody right. I assume anybody can interrupt and ask you a question.
Okay.
All okay. Right. So if you have a question for Dr. Osterman, feel free just to turn on your mic and ask your question.
Okay. All right. Well, we're closing out the legal portion here. So before we get into the accommodations review process portion, are there any questions about the legal concepts? All right. Well, hearing crickets, I'm going to keep going. All right, so based on everything we've just talked about, you can start imagining where our candidates are getting confused. They're getting confused because at their university or in their doctoral program, they were provided with accommodations. Right? And now all of a sudden, they're applying for accommodations on their licensure exam, and some cranky guy up in Minnesota is telling them, no, you're not a person with a disability. You're not entitled to accommodations. How could that be? When my university gave me accommodations, my doctoral program gave me accommodations, right? Why is it that all of a sudden the licensure board is saying, forget it? Okay. So we have to think about how it's different, the accommodations process and the purpose of the test is different. What's different from university to licensure? Oops. Got the slides in the wrong order. So let's keep talking about the differences here. So at the university level, or let's say at the entrance exam level, it might be the LSAT, it could be the GRE. The task at the university is a classroom test, right? The setting might be a big lecture hall at the University of Arizona with 300 other people in it, right? The purpose of accommodations at the university is to demonstrate what you know, to be successful, to get a good grade, right? On the entrance exam, like the LSAT or the MCAT or the GRE, it's an entrance exam. The entrance exams like the GRE and the LSAT and the MCAT, they claim to be able to predict how well somebody will do in graduate school, right? The test is often given in a large lecture hall type of setting, might be a hotel ballroom where they've set up desks, right? But what about when we get to something like the bar exam or the physical therapy licensure exam or a medical licensing exam. Now we're not measuring somebody's ability to potentially do well in graduate school. We're not measuring how well somebody did or what they know from chapter 4 of calculus, right? We're now measuring their competency. It's a standardized exam. It's a competency exam to see if they're fit to practice. So it's very different than university or graduate school. The test is typically administered at a standardized test center. People are sitting at these little study carrels. There may be a dozen or so people in there taking a test. It's not a huge lecture hall with hundreds of people all jibber jabbering and clickety clackety on their keyboards and so forth. It's a standardized test center. So the purpose is different, the task is different, the setting is different. It's very different from university. And this is what we have to try to explain to people. I want to go back to the mission, because this gets to the purpose of why we're administering the exams we administer. So what's your mission? Your mission is to protect the public. And if you look at the mission statements of virtually every licensure certification organization, you're going to see the same thing. The mission is to protect the public. NCARB is the organization that licenses architects. NCES is the organization that licenses engineers. And if you look at the nursing board, or you look at the optometry board, or you look at the cosmetology board for your state, any credentialing or licensure organization, their mission is going to be to protect the public, right? How is this different from the mission of a university? Well, the mission of the university is to have happy, successful graduates, to have good retention rates, good graduation rates, happy students that tell their friends how great it is at the University of such and such. Right? That's not your mission. Your mission is not to have happy candidates. Your mission is to protect the public. Right? And that's what we have to do. So we have to protect the public. That's the mission of the organization. At the same time, we are going to try, whenever possible, to provide reasonable accommodations to our candidates who have disabilities. But we're not going to do so to such an extent that the mission itself is compromised. Right? So if a candidate, for example, wants to waive a portion of your test, then the resulting score is not going to be meaningful. The test itself is really invalid. And so how can you ensure that the public is protected when you have a candidate who wants to waive a portion of your own test? Right, so that's an example of where somebody with a disability may say, I need this. And you say, well, if we give you this, we're undermining our own mission. Hopefully that makes sense to everyone. And there's just a citation there for a recent court case down in Virginia where the court affirmed that licensing organizations have the right and the power to regulate their profession and to establish reasonable standards for licensing practitioners. So hopefully that makes sense to everyone. All right, are there any questions about mission before we move on to reviewing accommodations requests?
So if I understand you correctly, even if they were provided accommodations in grad school, We are not bound by those accommodations when determining their ADA request.
Correct.
Great.
Right. Each organization has a responsibility and a right to make their own determination. So you have to consider, when you're making a determination, you have to consider your task, which is a standardized licensure exam, not a calculus test, right? Consider your task, your setting, and your purpose. And that's going to be different for different organizations. So the university has their tests for their purpose and their setting, and yours are different at the level of licensure. One thing I like to sometimes remind people of, in terms of each organization has their own right and responsibility to make a determination. You know, people who have disabilities will apply to receive disability benefits through Social Security, through the government. And they have their process, right, for their purposes at SSA. And somebody is not going to take a letter from me that says, well, John has approved me for accommodations on this test. They're not going to take that letter to SSA and say, now I demand a monthly disability check. SSA is going to say, well, forget it. We have our own process. We make our own determination. And that letter from Hosterman is nice, but that's not really going to cut it. We have our process. We have our forms. We have our guidelines. And you do too. So it's interesting that the university provided accommodations, but it does not obligate you to just take that carte blanche without any question.
That's excellent. Thank you.
I feel like that same slide has popped up about three or four times now. I have to go back through the slide deck and see why Bart keeps showing up. Maybe I'm clicking the wrong arrow. Right. So when we review accommodations requests for certification licensure, we ask four questions. Before we can approve somebody, they have to kind of clear these four hurdles here, these four questions. The first question is there impairment? Is there evidence of a valid diagnosis? Right? Remember, the definition of disability is an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. So the first piece of that is there evidence of impairment? I put in here optional because for the most part, we're not going to spend a great deal of time questioning somebody's diagnosis. So if somebody goes to the doctor and the doctor diagnoses whatever it is, could be anything, for the most part, we're not going to question that unless it really seems to be egregious. We don't really need to know what the diagnosis is or how it was made. We don't really need that. So that's why number one is optional, because the real question is number two. Whatever the diagnosis is, does it rise to the level of a disability? So we think back to that scale for multiple sclerosis. Just knowing the diagnosis doesn't tell me really anything about that person's functioning, right? And so people with that diagnosis might be disabled, might not be disabled with the same diagnosis. Well, the same thing is true for ADHD and learning disorders and depression and pretty much anything else you can think of. Just knowing the diagnosis doesn't tell me a lot about their functioning. So the question is, whatever the diagnosis is, does it rise to the level of a disability? Is it substantially limiting to the person compared to most people in the general population? And is there some objective evidence to support that? The third question, and we're going to go through each of these in more detail in a moment. So if you are scratching your head, just hang on. The third question is, assuming that the person has a valid diagnosis and it rises to the level of a disability, the third question is this accommodation going to enhance their access to the test? So let's say we have a person who is a wheelchair user, but cognitively they're perfectly normal and they're asking for double time on the test. We say, well, yes, you're a person with a disability. You've ticked that box, but how is giving you extra time on a test where you don't have to walk going to provide you with access to the test? Right? The accommodation is supposed to improve access for people with disabilities. And if you don't need extra time to read because your disability is in the area of walking or running, then I don't understand how you need extra time. So that's the question is the accommodation going to improve somebody's access to the test? Or does the accommodation seem to be requested in order to improve somebody's chances of success? The ADA requires access. The ADA requires equal access for people with disabilities. The ADA does not require any particular outcome. The ADA doesn't care about outcomes. The ADA does not care if somebody passes or finishes or is successful or works up to their fullest potential or is happy or any other outcome. The ADA requires access, period. So does the accommodation enhance their access? That's the third question. And then the last question is, assuming that we've met number one, number two, and number three, the last question is the accommodation reasonable and appropriate? We want to make sure that the accommodation isn't going to invalidate the test and its scores or compromise the security of the test. We don't want people walking out with test items. We don't want people cheating. So that's the fourth question. So let's break these down real quick. Number one, is there a valid diagnosis? For the most part, as I said, we're not going to question this. If it seems like it was made by a competent professional, somebody with a few letters with a D after their name, a PhD or a PsyD or an MD or an OD, something like that. For the most part, we're not going to question this. Unless it's really egregious and somebody has clearly made up a diagnosis. These are all things I've seen down here on the lower part of the screen where somebody has just decided to make up a diagnosis that you will not find in ICD-9 or DSM-5. So again, we're not going to question it for the most part unless it's something really, really weird. So as I said, the bigger question is, whatever that diagnosis is, does it rise to the level of a disability? Is it substantially limiting to a major life activity compared to most people? The documentation should be current. It should portray their current levels of functioning. What's current? Well, that might depend on the condition. Somebody who's deaf since birth, well, documentation that's 25 years old might be current because it still shows us what their current functioning is. On the other hand, somebody with condition that may change dramatically over time, current might be very recent. So if somebody has a broken arm, current might be, you know, like this week. We need a document from the doctor like this week because that condition is going to change pretty significantly. even some mental health conditions, PTSD, bipolar disorder, depression can change pretty significantly over a short period of time, particularly if somebody is struggling to find the right sort of combination of medications, therapy, and so forth, right? So a letter from a therapist about their PTSD that's 18 months old, that might be too old and not really tell us what their current levels of functioning are. Are they currently substantially limited or not? And just remember, every condition's got a range of impairment. Just knowing the diagnosis doesn't tell us if they're disabled. The next to last bullet here, if you think about it, if a person truly is disabled, it should not be tricky for them to come up with ways of documenting this. And I see so many candidates who are just scratching their head trying to figure out how to document their disability, how to document that they're substantially limited in a major life activity. All they seem to be able to do is provide documentation of their diagnosis, but not that they're substantially limited. And they say, well, Dr. Hosterman, tell me how I can document that I'm a person with a disability. I've given you the letter from the doctor that says I have ADHD. So, well, that's very nice, but you need to tell me, document how you're a person with a disability, not just that you're a person with a diagnosis. And if you really do have a condition that rises to the level of a disability, it should not be complicated to document that. So if you think about the person who's deaf, well, it's going to impact, that condition is going to impact many major life activities. The person is going to, how's the person going to communicate with the bank teller when they're trying to cash a check? Or checking out at Walgreens? Or going to their daughter's parent-teacher conferences? Or driving? Or many areas of daily life. So for a person who's deaf, documenting the fact that their hearing impairment rises to level of disability should be very straightforward, should not be complicated or tricky. And the same holds true for ADHD and dyslexia and everything else. If it rises to the level of a disability, where it really is substantially limiting, it should not be difficult to document that. If it is difficult to document, then they may not be a person with a disability. So here's some examples of evidence that people have used to document that their condition rises to the level of a disability. Many of our candidates are working at least part-time. Maybe they're working as an intern at a hospital. Maybe they're working part-time on the side just to make some extra money to get through grad school. Maybe they're a barista at Starbucks, whatever it is. I think many of our candidates are employed at least part-time doing something. And so my question is, okay, if you are a person with a disability, like the person who's deaf, how is it impacting your performance at work? And what accommodations do you need at work in order to meet your obligations? And what we hear from candidates is, oh, I have no problems at work. It's only on the test that I have an issue. Well, if test taking is the only area that you're impaired, then you're not a person with a disability. Okay. So from time to time, I get letters from people's employers that say, you know, this person has brought it to our attention and we've made these accommodations for them at work so they can perform the essential functions and duties of their job. So maybe it's a person with low vision who needs to have some kind of magnification software installed on their computer at work. That makes sense, right? So we get a letter from the supervisor or from human resources saying, yeah, we've done these things on the job for the person. To me, a letter from a work supervisor who knows the person really well, saying these are the accommodations that we've had to make it work, is a lot more valuable than a little note scribbled on the back of a napkin from their doctor that just says, Billy's been diagnosed with ADHD. That doesn't tell me anything. This, from the workplace, tells me that there's a real impact on major life activities. I hope this makes sense to everybody.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
There's a few other examples. Counselor's letter, multiple job losses, auto violation, moving violations are a huge one for people with ADHD. People who have attention deficit disorder to the point where it's disabling, they're terrible drivers. And there's a lot of research actually to back that up. You can think about somebody who is so inattentive and impulsive and distractible that it rises to level of disability. You can think about what kind of drivers they are. And it's not pretty. And so somebody who's got a suspended license because of 27 moving violations, gee, that's, you know, again, that's pretty good evidence that there's a substantial limitation to major life activities. Benefits from the government, veterans benefits in particular. We're seeing a lot of vets who've come back from Iraq or Afghanistan. They have a letter from the VA saying this person has a 80 or 90% disability rating. They're getting government benefits because of their condition. That's pretty good evidence right there. Well, all of these things on these two slides give me evidence that the person doesn't just have a diagnosis, but that it really is substantially limiting. It rises to the level of a disability. And this is, again, much more valuable to me, any of these types of things, than just a note from the doctor. So once somebody has provided evidence that they're a person with a disability, then the question is this access issue. Is the accommodation going to enhance their access to the test? Now, candidates, of course, want accommodations because they think it will help them do better. That's why virtually all 90, 95% of our candidates are requesting accommodations. It's not for access. It's because they think they're going to do better on the test. Right. Now, every once in a while, we get somebody, particularly those with a physical impairment, who need an accommodation in order to access the test, and that's what they're asking for. I just looked at one yesterday with somebody who's got severe kind of rheumatoid arthritis issue, and there may be an example of that coming up in the slides. She really has very limited use of her fingers. And so she's really not able to type very well on the computer. It's really very difficult for her. And so she's asking for a scribe to enter her answers for her. That's an access accommodation. That's an accommodation based on access need. Right? Now, most people, that's not the case. They're asking for accommodations in order to do better. So they want extra time so they can finish, or they want extra time so they can pass. Those are outcomes. And as I said earlier, the ADA does not care about outcomes. only access. So that's the third question here is, will the accommodation improve their access to the test? If not, then it's not appropriate. So here's some examples here. Person with low vision wants screen magnification. Is that going to improve access? Sure. What about the second one? A person has trouble sustaining their attention over time, and yet they request a seat assignment that's twice as long. We see this all the time. That second bullet. How's that going to enhance their access to the test? By sitting there for twice as long when they've just told us they have trouble sustaining their attention over time. So I'm going to think twice about the second bullet there. That doesn't make sense to me in terms of access. Remember, the third bullet there, you've got your person with the arthritis, wants a scribe or a special kind of keyboard. That makes sense. The next bullet, a person wants extra time so they have a better chance of passing. Well, that's an outcome. And the ADA does not care about outcomes. So that one is not gonna ring the bell on that one. The next bullet, somebody with a back injury wants a height adjustable workstation so they can stand for a little while and then sit for a little while taking the test. Maybe stretch a little bit in between. Well, that makes sense. That makes perfect sense to me. But what about the person who's in constant pain and they want to sit there for twice as long? Well, that doesn't make any sense. That I don't know how that's going to enhance their access to the test. So hopefully these are going to start making sense to you. This idea of access versus success, because that's really what we're looking at. Now, obviously, this is different than at the university, where the university or the school was really focused on student success. That was their goal, was to have successful students, passing their program, passing their classes, being happy. That was the school's mission. That was their goal. Your goal is to ensure that people who pass your test are competent to practice in order to protect the public. Right? So we get back to access and mission versus happy and successful students. Very different purpose. And then the last question of the four questions is, assuming they've ticked the box for 1, 2, and 3, a person with a disability, they want accommodations in order to access the test. The final question is making sure that the request is reasonable and appropriate. And there are a few sort of sub-questions here. Is the accommodation going to potentially jeopardize the standardized exam setting? And these are all actual requests. I didn't make any of these up. These are all things that people have asked for. People have a condition where they need it to be warmer, they need to be colder, they get really hot and sweaty, or they're freezing all the time, and they want us to adjust the temperature for the test. But we're not gonna do that because there are other people that are testing there and other people that are working there that don't want it to be set to 85 degrees.
Mr. Hosterman?
Yep.
I had an interesting one that you might want to add to this. I had one that said that she needed music played while she was examining.
Yeah. Well, there are people who have asked for background music that they can listen to with headphones or earbuds, and that it will help to block out distractions. And I don't know that we've made that exception very often, maybe once or twice, but that's an accommodation that would not impact other people. The problem we have with that is checking that device to make sure that it really is Beethoven that's on there and not something else, something nefarious, right? And then we also have the question of what device are they going to be listening from? Is it their phone? Because we can't have the phone there. But if they want music played in over the intercom system for the whole test center, I don't think anyone else is going to appreciate that. So these are all things on here that would impact more than just the person in question. It's going to impact other people too. And so we're not going to do any of these things. Then we have reasonable and appropriate. What about the validity of the test? Can we still depend on these scores being meaningful, or is the score meaningless? Obviously, if we give somebody an open book test, if we waive part of the test, if we give somebody unlimited time on the test, then whatever score they get is not going to be meaningful. And again, these are all actual examples. 11 times standard time, you think, well, how could that be an actual example? You must have made that up, John. No, that was an actual example. And that one went to court back in 2006 with somebody taking the MCAT, Medical College Admissions Test, that demanded 11 times standard time on the MCAT, which was a 7-hour test. So you do the math, and that this person would have been taking the MCAT over the course of weeks or months. And he sued the Medical College Admissions Test Program and took it to court over 11 times standard time. So, you know, it's interesting. There are people out there who will, you give them an inch, they'll take a mile on some of these things. And I've seen it. I don't know if I've seen it all, but I've seen a lot of it.
Are you allowed to say what happened on that last case?
Oh, sure. It's public. It's public information. It was thrown out. The 11 times standard time was thrown out. I was testifying in that case because I had just joined the MCAT program. And it was a case that had started before I got there. And it was interesting. I'll just devolve here for a moment on that particular one. So the individual claimed to have a visual impairment. He claimed that he was virtually blind. And he testified that, you know, when he opened his wallet, he couldn't tell the difference between a $5 bill and a $10 bill because his vision was so badly impaired, numbers on bills. And at one point, about halfway through the trial, he was given a new lawyer. The judge felt sorry for him and brought in a blind attorney to help him out because this guy was struggling so badly with his vision. And at one point, he thought they were off camera and their mic was turned off. And he started reading case notes to the blind attorney. And they were all these very complex legal documents that he was reading to his newly installed blind attorney. Unfortunately for him, the mic was hot and got the judge's attention. And she realized that she had been duped. And so the case was eventually thrown out. So there you have it, 11 times. Reasonable and appropriate test security is an issue. These are all actual examples. Nursing mother, she wasn't happy with whatever the setup was at the test center. You know, there was a conference room and they were going to put some curtains or something on it to give her some privacy, and that wasn't good enough. She wanted us to reserve a hotel room for her at the Hilton across the street. And she was going to go over there and nurse and then come back. And you can probably imagine what our response was to that one. People want mommy to be the reader. People want to bring in their own memory aids, their own study guides, cheat sheets, so forth. That's not going to happen. Any questions on test security issues? Hopefully these all make sense.
Doing great. Now, yeah.
Okay. Here's some examples of unreasonable requests. So what's unreasonable? Well, these are the types of requests that come to us that probably started out in somebody's childhood IEP at their elementary school or middle school. And these things were appropriate back in third grade or eighth grade. And they've been sort of rubber stamped every year or two or three since then. Well, now the person is 25 and they're taking their licensure exam. And these recommendations from the doctor, the psychologist are still there. And they're just not appropriate anymore. They may have been appropriate at a much earlier time, but now on their licensure exam, the doctor is not going to clarify questions for them. The last bullet is really a charm. Reduce the number of answer choices. I've seen that three times so far in the last number of years, 10 years, maybe not even 10, where somebody claims to be so distractible that five answer choices is too many for them, and they need it reduced to two answer choices. Yeah, so that's not going to happen. So here's a few more examples. You're going to get to decide for yourself if you think they're reasonable or not. If you don't know The Onion, I highly recommend it. The line between reality and insanity is sometimes very, very thin these days. So here's a request. Candidate has diabetes. Clearly, they're a person with a disability, right? There's no question that this is a person with a disability. They want a little extra time to check their blood sugar, take their meds. They want access to snacks, right? Let's talk about snacks and beverages. So people with diabetes, they need some kind of quick sugar, you know, so whether that's, a piece of candy, glucose tablets, maybe they need a glass of orange juice, that makes sense. But what some people have decided snacks means is something different. And we've had people who've been approved for snacks because of diabetes bring in all kinds of bags full of junk food to the test center. Again, this falls under the category of give them an inch, they'll take a mile. We had somebody at Pearson View who we nicknamed the hot dog lady because literally she wanted to bring in a dozen hot dogs and line them up on the proctor station with all the buns and all the condiments. And when she got hungry, she was going to eat a hot dog during the test. And she wanted the proctor to keep all this for her at the proctor station. And this was because of diabetes. So it's got to be reasonable. What about extra time in case somebody has a medical event during the test? Well, if somebody has a medical event during the test, the proctor is going to call 911. Extra time is not going to be the solution for them. So that part doesn't seem to make sense. I hope everybody would agree with these things. So the extra time, the 30 minutes, the blood sugar, medication, maybe some hard candy, granola bar, glass of juice, all of that makes sense. A dozen hot dogs, double time, does not make sense. We've had a number of requests from people who have narcolepsy, and they want some sort of provision to be able to take naps during the test. They want the proctor to wake them up if they fall asleep and sleep for too long. They want a cot or a mat where they can take naps during the test. Anybody have any thoughts about this?
Craziness.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
No questions.
Yeah. Okay. Now, here's a person who has a physical condition. I think this one was somebody who had a back injury from an auto accident. And it's hard for her to sit for a long period of time in one position. And so she asked for an extra 60 minutes of time so that she could take breaks from time to time and stand and stretch and do exercises that maybe her physical therapist or somebody had recommended for her. And she wanted a private room so that all the standing and stretching wouldn't disturb other people. Does that make sense to everyone? That should make sense. That should sound pretty good to most people. Yep. That seems reasonable. Just keep in mind here, the note at the bottom, most people are not going to ask for something reasonable. Most people are going to say they want double time. Right? So they want to take a 6-hour test over the course of 12 hours because it's painful for them to sit. Right? So what we have to do in these kind of cases when somebody asks for something that may not be reasonable is try to ratchet it back to something that is reasonable. Say, well, you know, don't you think an extra 60 minutes would be enough? That's quite a few extra breaks you can take to stretch. Do you really want to sit there for 12 hours instead of 6 hours? Nursing mother, I don't think we want anyone to get into that one. Here's a couple of examples. Please don't copy these. These are typically, I'm going to go through these kind of quick because I want to leave some time for questions. These are examples where a medical doctor has diagnosed something, but not really provided evidence that the condition rises to a level of a disability or given us any kind of information about what accommodations would improve the person's access to the test. So here we have an example where Janet has been diagnosed with sleep apnea, high blood pressure, she's overweight, she has asthma. Now, I'm not going to question the doctor and say, well, I don't believe that Janet has high blood pressure. If the doctor says she does, then she does. But the question for me is, does any of this rise to the level of a disability? And then if it does, how does extra time provide her with access to the test? And so this one is going to get reviewed very quickly and sent back to Janet as incomplete. Although there may be a valid diagnosis here, there's nothing else to work with in terms of, is this a disability? And how does the accommodation of extra time provide her with access? And there's lots of examples of this. I'll give you a couple more here. Here's somebody with ADD. The doctor's diagnosed it. That's great. Person has ADD, whatever. But there's nothing here that tells me that the person has a disability. The doctor's conflated disability with diagnosis, and he said Connie has a permanent disability. Well, she has maybe a diagnosis, but there's no evidence that it rises to the level of a disability. And there's lots of these here. Here's a neurologist that's diagnosed hypertension and glaucoma. I don't know why the neurosurgeon is veering out of his lane here to diagnose glaucoma. Here's a psychiatrist that's diagnosed ADHD, and he's recommending various things. I'm not going to necessarily question the psychiatrist about the diagnosis of ADD, but whether it rises to the level of disability or not is unclear. Here's a cardiologist that's diagnosed ADD. He's veered way out of his lane of traffic. So I'm not even going to believe the diagnosis on this one. But even if I were to believe the diagnosis, I have no evidence that Elizabeth is disabled. This is what's curious. You'll see up at the top here, part one. This is a note by a medical doctor who's diagnosed Michael with ADD. And you'll see it's part one. Obviously, this note is not going to be sufficient for me or for the physical therapy board, because although the diagnosis might be valid, there's nothing here that tells me it rises to a level of a disability or what accommodations Michael needs or would be appropriate. But based on this little note, the university has decided he's disabled and granted him a whole raft of accommodations, double time, private room, eating and drinking in class, note-taking help. So based on this little handwritten note, Michael's university has gone ahead and decided he's disabled and approved all these things.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
So do you send these applications back as incomplete?
Yes.
And so you don't deny them, you just send them back as incomplete?
Incomplete. I don't have enough information to approve or deny.
Thank you.
Here's another one. Here's part one. This doctor has diagnosed Monica with ADD. She's on treatment for it. She has trouble focusing. Please accommodate her. This note tells me nothing other than this Monica has a diagnosis. I don't have any information here that she's a person with a disability or what accommodations would be appropriate. But based on this little note from the doctor, the University of Washington, a very highly respected institution, has decided she's a person with a disability and needs a whole raft of accommodations. What's going to happen now is Monica is going to take this note and this letter from the University of Washington, and she's going to bring those things to us at the physical therapy board, and she's going to say, well, now I need accommodations on my licensure exam. And we're going to say, no, it's incomplete. We don't have any evidence that you're a person with a disability. You have to go back. And she's going to say, well, it was good enough for the university. Why shouldn't it be good enough for you? We say, well, we're not questioning your doctor's diagnosis, but you need to tell us how you're a person with a disability. So you can see what's happening here with all of these. UCLA Health, very respected institution. I don't even know if this letter is legitimate or not, because we've got, I don't know who signs their name, Timothy, MD. Does anybody know a medical doctor who signs letters, Timothy, MD? Very strange. So we're not quite sure where this came from. Here's another doctor who's claiming that Michael needs accommodation secondary to some medical issues. I don't know what that is. These all go back as incomplete. Now, here's a couple of examples I want to show you from employers. These are really good. These are really good examples. So Andrea has been employed as an intern for this engineering firm. And her ADD is such that it is really impacting her ability to perform her duties at work. And so the employer has worked with Andrea to come up with some accommodations for her at work. They've converted, it looks like they've converted an extra supply closet into a private office for Andrea. So presumably this is a very small room that has no windows and hence no distractions. And so they've made this into an office for Andrea, and they've noticed that her ability to perform her duties have improved. So I look at this letter and I say, boy, this is really good evidence that Andrea doesn't just have a diagnosis of ADD, but this thing really does rise to the level of a disability. It really is substantially limiting to Andrea in major life activities like work. And she really does need accommodations to mitigate that. So this letter here from Andrea's employer to me is far more valuable than one of these little dopey notes from a doctor.
So even though the employer is not a doctor, you would still accept his letter?
I would accept this letter as part of Andrea's accommodations package. I would probably still want to see something from a diagnostician, but if I got this along with one of these little dinky letters from a doctor, that would be enough for me. Yes.
Just making sure.
Yep. There actually are some credentialing organizations in the UK that require for their adult applicants, they require a letter from the employer. They don't require a letter from the doctor. When you think about Andrea here, who knows her better? Her employer, who sees her for 8 hours a day, or her doctor, who sees her for 5 minutes once or twice a year? Right. Here's another one from an employer. Jimmy's supervisor has written to describe Jimmy's difficulties with written communication, and they've made various modifications and accommodations for him at work to accommodate his written expression difficulties. Again, this is pretty powerful to me. And I want to just go through real quickly. You'll get the gist of these slides. We've kind of talked about communicating with candidates, making sure you have a good process that's transparent to candidates. I'm happy to talk with you about this in a separate meeting if we need to, making sure that your policies and your procedures are clear to candidates, that tell candidates what we've been talking about today, that it's not enough to just have a diagnosis. You need to provide evidence that you're a person with a disability and the accommodation is meant to enhance your access to the test. Maybe that provides a little discussion of how this may be different than their accommodations at university or in their doctoral program may have been. Having clear documentation guidelines for candidates. So these are all things we talked about today that you just need to make sure get communicated to candidates so that they can read and try to grapple with some of these things ahead of time, rather than when they get this letter saying, sorry, your request is incomplete. How could it be incomplete? It was good enough for the University of whatever. Making sure all this is communicated to candidates ahead of time. Okay, I'm sorry I ran through the last few slides, but we've got about 10 minutes, so I'm gonna try to get off of.
There you go. I think you did it.
Hey, I can see you guys.
There you go. So, Dr. Hausman, we get a lot of requests due to anxiety.
Yeah. And
can you speak to that at all?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that most of your test takers are anxious. You know, it's a high stakes exam. They've spent many years preparing. It's going to make the difference between employment or not employment. You know, it's a huge, huge milestone for your candidates. And I'd be surprised if anybody wasn't anxious. So the issue of whether people are anxious or not is sort of moot because they're all anxious. The question really is, do they have anxiety to the point where it's disabling in major life activities, not just on your licensure exam, right? Your licensure exam is not a major life activity, all right? And so I want to find out how this anxiety rises to level of a disability for this person in major life activities. Are they so anxious all the time that it's disabling to them, right? If somebody is so anxious that it's disabling, can they drive in rush hour traffic in Phoenix, right? What about going to the supermarket? What about other high stress situations like going to the doctor or the dentist, right? If the only impact is on test taking, they're not a person with a disability because test taking is not a major life activity.
Very good.
Thank you.
I appreciate that clarification, Dr. Hausman, because while taking the test maybe isn't passing it and their livelihood afterwards is, you know, and so your clarification of access versus outcomes, I think, was super enlightening. So thank you.
Yeah.
Dr. Hausman, a question. I was envisioning myself as Monica or Veronica for a moment. And I was wondering, do you have any language recommendations that they can communicate to licensees and candidates? You know, specifically beyond, you stated it rather well, you know, to describe how it's impacting their life. But I'm wondering, is there a site that Monica and Veronica or whomever can direct these candidates to so that their application is more robust and complete rather than tasking these two with sort of explaining the situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's probably something that we should take as a discussion offline at some point in the near future. What I would like to tell you is to have candidates directed to FSBPT's site, which lays all this out for them. However, we're in the midst right now of refreshing those pages at FSBPT. And so at some point in the next couple of months, that would be probably a solution, is just to say to your candidates, you know, that you're going to make your own decision. FSBPT isn't making the decision for you. But if you want to see some examples of the kinds of things we're going to be looking for, here are some documentation guidelines. Here's kind of a process you can see. We're going to be following, you know, that same type of process when we're making our decisions in Arizona. So that would be, you know, one thing you could do. But I just, with the caveat that we are in the process of revising those.
And thank you for this very insightful presentation. I appreciated it very much.
Yes, I enjoyed it as well. And I thought that the thought that when you went over like letters from employers, I thought, well, you know, they should be able to supply letters from their clinical instructors.
Right.
You know, they haven't really had a job, but they've had a clinical instructor who would be able to provide evidence that they really do have a disability.
Right.
They have difficulty reading and, you know, understanding. Because that's always been my question, is if they have problems reading and understanding a question, do they have problems reading and understanding a physician's order?
Right. That's a little scary, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if the person says, oh, I'm fine in my clinicals, I have no problem in my clinicals, it's only the test where I'm having difficulty, then again, we get back to this, well, you're not really a person with a disability then, if the only impact is on the test. They should be able to demonstrate that there's an impact on a day-to-day basis in their clinicals too. And I'd be delighted to hear from their clinical supervisor saying, you know, there is an impact here, and here are the accommodations or modifications we've made for them in their clinicals to be able to get through that.
Yeah, thank you.
I would suspect that that's not going to happen very often, though. Anybody else?
No, I thought it was very well, very, very profitable for us. So good. Thank you.
Good. Happy to help. So Karen, Monica, others, maybe we can have a quick conversation at some point in the next few weeks about how to implement some of this, or how to communicate some of this to candidates.
That would be awesome. We'll definitely set that up with you.
Sounds good.
All right. We appreciate your time. Thank
okay,
you so
guys.
Very much.
Thank you.
Take care. Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let me stop the recording, and then we'll come back in. We have one last piece of business.